Florida does not have to change its system for restoring the voting rights of felons, at least for now.
Politics this week, a bipartisan governor's ticket. What about it? And how about some politicians who may have used your Facebook data?
Also, clearing up a question over solar panels in the state. It's a move toward getting more power from the sun.
This is the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. A last-minute appeals court ruling this week allows Florida's process to restore voting rights for felons to stand. They'll still have to ask the governor, though, to return their rights. The primaries for governor are just 4 months away, and could there be a two-party ticket? And the state's utility regulator says leasing solar panels is not the same as selling electricity made from the sun.
You can join the conversation statewide, 305-995-1800. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. It's the statewide edition this hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, this Friday, lots of moves and counter moves over a hot issue in the state, restoring voting rights to felons. Now, earlier this week, Governor Rick Scott called an emergency meeting of the state clemency board, but then he canceled it after a federal appeals court decided the governor, well, he didn't have to change how the state deals with restoring voting rights for felons. Last month, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker gave the state a deadline to create a new system for restoring felon rights. That deadline was supposed to be yesterday. Back in February, the judge ruled the system is unconstitutional and arbitrary.
But what happened this week, Melissa, was that an appeals court issued a stay as it considers the state's case. Now, Governor Scott has said the current restoration process is outlined in the Florida Constitution. It has been in place for more than a century. Felons in Florida have to wait up to 7 years after they've served their time before they can apply to have their voting rights restored. Then it can take years to get that request considered by the clemency board. Now, that's in contrast to most states where felons who complete their jail terms automatically get those voting rights back.
That's right, Tom. Voting rights advocates say here in Florida, 1.5 million convicted felons may be disenfranchised under this current system. Meanwhile, hundreds of protesters rallied at the state capitol Thursday in support of a citizens initiative. It'll be on the ballot this November. It's Amendment 4. Voters will decide this November whether they want to restore felons' right to vote. The Reverend Al Sharpton was there. He and other civil rights advocates said Governor Scott, who's currently running for U.S. Senate, wants to suppress the vote.
Y'all got all these elections going around in Florida. Tell me the governor want to be the senator and all that. Why are you afraid, Governor Scott, of more folk being allowed to vote?
It's a fraud issue, and we're beginning the hour here on the Florida Roundup with the latest on this as we welcome Gary Fineout, reporter with the Associated Press, and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. And we want your calls, too. Where do you stand on this issue? Will you vote up or down on Amendment 4 to restore voting rights for felons in Florida? The number to call the show now is 305-995-1800. Gary Fineout, let's begin with you. A rally there at the Capitol. But there's been a lot of back and forth over this. Let's bring folks up to date. This is being challenged. Governor Scott is saying the current system should remain, that it's enshrined in the Florida Constitution. How so?
Well, Florida's Constitution for a long time has had this lifetime ban on felons being able to have their rights restored once they have been convicted of a crime. Now, the roots of it go back to the post-Civil War era, but it was included in rewrites of the Constitution, including one that was done in 1968. And the situation is that it's sort of what's in the Constitution is you can ban them and you can not have them have their rights, and then it takes an act of clemency by the governor and members of the cabinet in conjunction with him to grant those rights back. Now, what's happened over the years is that this process has been shifted back and forth depending on who's in power. When Charlie Crist was governor, they sort of broadened the way that you could get your rights restored, and they made it much easier. And they basically said if you had not committed certain crimes, you could get your rights automatically restored once you did your sentence and had paid your fines and had done your parole or probation. When Governor Scott came in, he and Attorney General Bondi pushed to change it to a much more strict system that we have now in place, which basically says you can't even apply for your rights until you've been at least 5 years removed from your conviction. Now, the defense from the governor's office and his people is that we want to make people prove that they've earned the right to vote back. And as you pointed out, though, this is not how it works in most states in the nation.
Gary, it's Tom. Let me ask you about the appeals court stay. This essentially was a decision to tell the clemency board, the cabinet of the state of Florida, led by Governor Scott, that they did not have to rewrite these rules by the deadline that Judge Walker had originally set out while they still consider the case. This is not to say they ruled on the merits of the case or the merits of the current system or any other system for clemency, correct?
That is correct. And important noting, it was a split decision. It was a 2-1 mm-hmm. decision in which the court basically said that they were going to go ahead with the stay. And they basically said, we don't want to have a disruption in the system. We don't want to have new rules put in place and then suddenly have them change depending on how we rule. What is important to note is in the decision, however, the court said, we feel that the state of Florida has proven their point and there are past precedents in related to this legal battle, including cases that involved Florida previously, about whether the ban itself it passes constitutional muster. Now, of course, if you kind of roll this out, what you can see is, well, maybe eventually it would go to the full appeals court, and maybe you'd have an en banc decision at mm-hmm. some point in time. Mm-hmm. But that, of course, is going to take time and everything on that. And as we know, probably, you know, before all of that is resolved, we're going to have a vote of the people in November on whether to change the system.
That's right. And it's 305-995-1800. Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup as we discuss this issue of how the state could or should restore voting rights for a million or more felons. A.G. Gankarski, writer for Florida Politics, as Gary Fineout just pointed out, in the fall, the voters could settle this with this citizens' initiative called Amendment 4. We saw the protest in Tallahassee yesterday that attracted Al Sharpton and others. And so this could ultimately just become something that voters have their say on. But as you've been covering this, we see bipartisan majorities around the state seem to support the idea of restoring voting rights for this population more quickly than they are now.
Right. But the amendment's got to clear 60%. You know, that's something about state amendments. And, you know, we're going to see this play out amongst a very partisan race in November. You know, Rick Scott has been very adamant. He said that people who commit heinous crimes, he told me this yesterday, people who commit heinous crimes should not have the right to vote. And there's a large swath of people that agree. And I think as we get closer to the amendment, you're going to see the advertising campaign. You know, do you want to give people committed of violent assault and so on? Do you want to give them the right to vote? Do you want to give them suffrage if they earn citizenship? That's ultimately the question. And, you know, what we also see with state amendments, and we saw with Amendment 2, is there's a gap between what the amendment says and implementation. There are all kinds of legal challenges. There are all kinds of things that can happen with the amendment. So it's not quite as simple as the amendment passes and then, you know, everything works out. Now, if we get a Democratic governor, you know, after November, you'll see wholesale changes, absolutely. But, you know, I think the amendment's got more of a way to go than some people might think based on polls.
We've got some phone calls here from throughout the state of Florida. You can join the conversation. Restoring felon rights is our topic right now here on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800. We'll begin in Fort Lauderdale, where Javier is with us on line 4. Javier, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was calling because I had submitted a request for clemency before Obama came into power, two terms. It's been like 14 years that I've been waiting, and they never responded to any of my applications for clemency. And my charge was back in the late 80s for driving on a suspended license. It was a traffic offense. And it says, like I said, for driving on a suspended license. And then when I try to get it restored or whatever, 3 or 4 different applications have been submitted for more than 14 years, and I'm still waiting. They never responded. So I'm not sure that the process that they have even works, because they never respond to the applications for clemency in the first place anyway. And I'm saying that after 14 years of submitting, after submitting 4 or maybe 5 applications, because when they didn't respond to the first one, I submitted a second one and a third one and a fourth one, and none of them got answered or responded to for 14 years.
So your driving on a suspended license is a felony charge, Javier. That's what you're saying?
Right. They charged me with driving on a felony driving on a suspended license. If you get caught more than twice, it becomes a felony.
Right,
the first time it's a misdemeanor.
Okay.
More than twice, it becomes a third-degree felony.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a traffic offense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, only a from traffic court.
Right, but
and
still a felony.
Years of waiting.
And you've gotten no response at all from the clemency
never.
Department. Javier?
My multiple applications that I submitted, one after another, they never responded to any of those applications.
Got it. Gary, is the clemency board, regardless of who the governor is, under any kind of regulation to respond either yay or nay to a clemency request?
Well, here's where it gets a little bit complicated. So basically, the act of clemency and the board of clemency and how they handle things is a constitutional responsibility. And basically, there are rules that are drawn up by the governor and cabinet that sort of lay out things. Now, what's interesting is when they had that emergency meeting and then they canceled at the last minute, they issued new rules that they were going to contemplate. One of the things in those new rules was every application had to be responded to within 4 years. And that was partly what was cited by Judge Mark Walker in his ruling was you just can't have this sort of, as he said, the states lock your rights in a crypt and the state swallows the key. He even got into the whole point of applications – there's no the state does not have any requirement to act on them in a timely fashion. And so the clemency board does have the wherewithal where they can just continue to investigate or they can look into something and they can decide. And the other problem is we as members of the public and the press, we can't really look at and see closely at what they're doing because all the records that are compiled on people who ask for clemency – They compile a dossier or file on whether or not they should be considered for to have their rights restored. None of that is public record. You can't even see what they're using to consider the case.
AG Gankarski, the face of this movement in Florida is a guy named Desmond Mead. He's leading the Rights Restoration Coalition, pushed for the amendment that will be on the ballot this fall, and he's one of about 1.5 million disenfranchised Florida felons. You know, the conservative columnist George Will wrote about this recently and pointed out that's more people than voted in 22 states in the 2016 presidential election. He's one of the 20% of African-American Floridians who've been disenfranchised. Of course, this is a population that tends to vote more Democratic. And so it's become quite the partisan issue in this swing state. As felons press for their full voting rights to be restored, as we're heading into what's expected to be a contentious and close midterm election here in Florida. The politics of this are certainly pretty intense.
Yes, they are. And, you know, if you were restoring the rights of 1.5 million felons, by far the largest amount of disenfranchised people in any state in the country, I mean, that would swing statewide elections. It would mean that Democrats would win statewide offices. It would mean that, you know, somebody like Bill Nelson would have advantage over Rick Scott in a race. And even in the 2016 race, Patrick Murphy would have had a better shot against Marco Rubio. I mean, this is a significant thing. And, you know, Governor Scott, I mean, he defends what he does. He defends the position. He says that, you know, the 3,000 people that we've given voting rights to, we review their cases, I look at them personally, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you're meeting quarterly like the clemency board is, comprised of the Florida cabinet, you're not doing much on it. And, you know, what you're going to see in the post-Rick Scott era is some remedy to the situation, you know, whether it be through the courts or through something else, because, you know, I think most people, you know, except for diehard Republicans, you know, understand that there's a gap between intention and reality with this, because if you're looking at the penal system as a reform, then it follows that people should have an ability to get their right to vote back. And, you know, we heard from the caller talking about, you know, being suspended for, you know, felony, you know, suspended license. I mean, so there are incidents like that. There is, you know, those can be brought up, and those are to counter Rick Scott's case.
It's 305-995-1800 as we talk about this issue of restoring the rights of felons to vote in the state. Where do you stand? Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Meredith is in Jacksonville. Hi, Meredith.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to say, go back to A.G. Gankarski's quote from the governor about letting people who've committed heinous crimes vote after they've served their time. And that's just not the case. It makes me wonder if the governor's even read this, because violent offenders and sex offenders, this wouldn't apply to them. They would not get their voting rights back. And I think that's something that has been left out of this conversation and that a lot of people don't understand, is that violent offenders and sex offenders would not get their voting rights back. So it wouldn't be heinous offenders.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Meredith, you're right. And yeah, the ballot amendment specifically does state that persons convicted of murder or felony sexual offense would not be eligible to regain the franchise. AG, so it does exclude those more violent felons from this.
Right, and you know that again illustrates the gap between the governor's rhetoric and the reality of the situation, and I thank Meredith for pointing that out, because that's something that gets lost in a noise machine.
Let's return to the phone calls here. South Miami in Dade County, Paul on line 10. Let me pull it up here. Paul, good afternoon. Thanks for calling. You're on the statewide Florida Roundup.
Hi. I've done a fair amount of research in this area. And withholding the restoring of felons' rights does absolutely nothing to help the public safety. In fact, the research is very clear that it does only increase recidivism rate. In other words, the goal in other states is to help the felon, once they leave incarceration, reintegrate into society. This racist, pathetic law and the procedures that came into effect after the Civil War only to prevent freed slaves from voting, we should be embarrassed to still have that on our books. It is absolutely disgusting.
Paul, we hear you in South Miami. Thank you. We got a lot more calls to get to. We appreciate your conversation, your report. Thanks for sharing your research with us.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's go to Ahmed in Fort Myers. Hey, Ahmed, how are you?
Well, thank you. How are you guys?
Okay, go ahead.
Well, my question actually is a couple of things. Most likely felons are very financially disadvantaged folks. So how can they afford the whole process of appealing and follow-up on that? Does anybody help them with this, or are we just intentionally trying to disfranchise those group of people, knowing that they are 1.5 million? And my second part is, why is the appeal and the decision is made secret? Why this is not a public record where we can see who applied and what was the reason to be refused? Thank you very much.
Yeah, Ahmed. Gary Finat, what about those points?
Well, let me be clear about the whole secrecy. So what I was referring to is the actual information used by the governor and cabinet to make a conclusion, to make a decision. Now, when someone applies and then they have to have a hearing, there's two kind of categories. There's without a hearing and there's with a hearing. When they have a hearing and they have these hearings four times a year, that is in public. And they discuss and debate, and the person is invited to appear before the governor and cabinet, and they'll have a conversation.
Gary, we got less than a minute before the break, just to let you know.
Yeah, but so in other words, that part is not secret. But the point is that all the information that they're used, whether or not it's a report from a prosecutor or something like that, that is completely confidential, and the governor can happen to have the discretion to decide. And then the thing is that they will then make a decision sometimes in the meeting, and then sometimes they'll just leave it for later.
We're going to continue the conversation about this and some other big political news and notes from the week all across the state here on the Florida Roundup this Friday. Yes, give us a call from whatever corner of the state you call home as we talk about a bipartisan ticket for governor. That and a lot more coming up with Gary Finat and A.G. Gankarski with us. This is the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening this week. It could be just the ticket to bridge the partisan divide. Maybe, Melissa, you know, perhaps.
Never know.
The red state, blue state, purple state that is Florida, two former congressmen say they're considering running on a bipartisan ticket for this fall's governor's race.
That's right, Tom. Democrat Patrick Murphy and Republican David Jolly both served in Congress from here in Florida. They've talked politics together on this show before.
Yep.
And they've been on a tour all over the state, even the country, to explain the gridlock in Washington and why it needs to end. And now they're actually polling a little bit to see if voters in Florida would be interested in their bipartisan Murphy-Jolly ticket. The idea would be to have Murphy run for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, and if he wins, he'd pick Jolly to be his running mate. Now, Jolly can often be seen on cable TV speaking out against President Trump. And, you know, you kind of have to wonder, should it be a Jolly Murphy ticket? Jolly's the more senior member, but I guess they like it the way it is.
Well, maybe. And maybe it tells us about the Republican primary and how that's shaping up in the governor's race as much as it tells us about the Democrats think about how the Democratic primary is shaping up for the gubernatorial ticket. So could this bipartisan red state, blue state ticket have a chance? Gary Finout from the Associated Press is still with us. He is in the Tallahassee studios of our sister station in the capital city, WFSU. A.G. Gankarski is with us from WJCT in Jacksonville, A.G. with Florida Politics. Gary, first of all, I don't know if you need to throw cold water on this idea or what, though. I mean, lots of rumor, lots of talk. Yes, some polling. What's the reality of it, though? What are the odds of this happening in your estimation?
Well, I'm not sure it's going to come to fruition. I think it's an interesting idea and a good topic to talk about and an idea to cut through the polarization that we have in our politics in the state. There are a few technical things that would need to be worked out. I mean, first of all, I'm hearing differing attitudes about the legality of the issue, having more to do with the fact that you have to be a particular party for a certain period of time before you can qualify for things. Although the conversation is, if Jolly is a Republican and it's just the LG spot, that maybe that wouldn't apply.
Right.
There's an open question about that. My understanding has been lawyers who have looked at this. To me, what's interesting about this and the way that it kind of got everyone's attention this week is whether or not it says a lot about the state of the race and whether or not the fact that there are other Democrats in the race and no one seems to have really run away with it and really caught fire and really got people excited about the prospect of the upcoming election. And that's what I find. And now, I mean, I think we also need to put the fact is, yes, Jolly's been on TV and Murphy ran statewide, but Murphy lost.
Right.
He's a congressman from one part of the state. I'd be interested in knowing what his name recognition is even after running against Marco Rubio.
All right, and losing against Marco Rubio. 305-995-1800. What about it? A bipartisan ticket for governor? Do you like that idea at all? Do you like a purple ticket there as you go into your voting booth in November? Should it come to that? Is this about the lack of excitement on Democrats? And A.G. Gankarski, what does it tell us if, you know, the idea being floated here is Murphy at the top of this Democrat-Republican possibility as opposed to Congressman Jolly at the top of that ticket?
Well, I think that's a practicality because Murphy is in a position to run in the Democratic primary, theoretically. Adam Putnam, running as a Republican for governor, made the point that, well, if this ticket happens, you'll have a former Republican at the top and a current Republican, you know, at the bottom, and that's your Democratic standard bearer. And so it leaves it
he
wide
open. He threw a little shade on this idea, didn't he?
Yeah,
quite
a bit.
A lot.
But, I mean, that distills the problem here. If the Democratic bench is so empty, you know, of first-tier candidates that – you know, somebody like Murphy could catch fire against people who have run rank campaigns like Gwen Graham and Andrew Gillum for a year now. It raises existential questions. I mean, we're in the year of the blue wave. So this is the year periodically where, you know, if Democrats are going to take this office, conditions are favorable.
You don't see a bipartisan ticket catching fire, even in a swing state like Florida, in a year when Democrats are really strongly motivated, particularly base Democrats, to go to the polls to express their anger. I think particularly the feedback we get anyway from base voter Democrats against the Trump administration and voting in this midterm election is a way to send that message, even though you're voting for down ticket races. You're voting in an off-year election.
Right. And, you know, Murphy also, I mean, this goes back to the name ID point that Gary brought up. He didn't run much of a campaign north of I-4. In terms of what he did in this part of the state, in terms of what he did in the panhandle, he did nothing. And so I question the viability. It's a nice idea. I think consultants can get paid off of it, but I don't think that dog's going to hunt.
I think that's what Lyndon Johnson used to say, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of people said it.
Yeah, that dog won't hunt.
Lawton Charles.
Yeah, yeah, the dog may not hunt, Gary, but our funder is going to fund something like this.
Well, as I'm sure AG and other people have already noted, it's part of the attraction of Mr. Murphy is that his family connections and the fact that he could probably have the wherewithal to have his family help him out and get some significant resources into the race. I mean, I think we have Philip Levine, the former mayor of Miami Beach. He is pouring some of his own money into the race, but there right now there is a distinct a growing gap in terms of advantages in terms of financial resources. Putnam is way out in front, and you know, his opponent in his primary, Ron DeSantis, while he doesn't have as much money right now, of course he has the luxury, as you would say, of being able to go on Fox News, which is going to communicate directly to GOP primary voters. So he has his way to get his message out. Putnam has his organization. And he has the financial resources, but when we look at these other Democrats, other than Philip Levine, who's put several million dollars of his own money into the race, you just don't see them being able to keep pace. And so that's probably why part of the attraction for Murphy is like, well, he might be able to at least have the ability to get a substantial amount of money into the race. We have to recall that with everything and starting with Rick Scott back in 2010. Races in Florida are really, really expensive. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about, you know, we think in the U.S. Senate race between Scott and Nelson, I mean, I'm sure we're all expecting that well over $100 million will be spent on that race.
Easy. Yeah, it could be the most expensive Senate campaign in American history. A.G. Gankarski, what about Gary's point that Ron DeSantis has the advantage of substantial name recognition around Florida with Republican primary voters because he's such a regular guest on Fox News, even though Adam Putnam has a bigger campaign war chest? You know, a state like Florida, that constant TV exposure with all of our far-flung big TV markets, that's a major asset for him.
Yeah, but that cuts both ways. I mean, and this gets to Putnam's point. Putnam says he knows Florida best. That's what his campaign boils down to. When DeSantis does Hannity or Ingraham or one of those Fox News shows, he's talking about national issues. He's defending President Trump, which does play well with the base, but doesn't address Florida issues. Talking about Comey or Mueller or whatever. And it's like all these things are basically national issues. So DeSantis still hasn't really demonstrated why he's running for governor. And I think that's the question that Republican primary voters are going to be considering. And, you know, beyond the Fox News hits, there's not a lot of campaign to DeSantis campaign yet.
Where's he been appearing around Florida? If anywhere, for example, you covered Adam Putnam's appearance in Jacksonville the other day.
Right. He does Trump clubs, DeSantis does, and things like that, like little party gatherings. But in terms of getting out there and doing the things that politicians historically do who win races, he's not doing it. You know, he might be able to win from 40,000 feet up, but it's going to be difficult because Putnam's got a very disciplined campaign. It's very textbook. And, on the state issues, Putnam owns DeSantis right now.
One of the places that we know DeSantis is going to appear, along with Adam Putnam and Richard Corcoran, the current Speaker of the Florida House, possible GOP gubernatorial candidate. The three of them, I got an email this week that the first time the three of them are going to be together is going to be for a county Republican Party event in the deep blue county in South Florida of Broward County. Gary, what is this strategy here? These two Republicans we know are running for the race. One of them may throw his hat in, but an appearance of all three of them together for the first time in the most Democratic county in the state.
Well, I would always want to point out that while Broward is a treasure trove of Democratic votes, it also, by virtue of its population, has a large number of Republicans.
Yeah, yeah.
And people kind of forget that. I mean, you want to try to do better with all the Republicans across the state. And I just want to jump on AG's point, you know, relatively, you know, earlier. I totally agree with what he was saying about DeSantis and versus Putnam, because I mean, it's going to be an interesting test. If Putnam is the way we ran campaigns in Florida, the way it was done and the grassroots, and you build up the money and you just relentlessly go out and do barbecues and appearances and stuff like that. He is from the older generation. He is part of the way that we've done it in Florida. And yet with Rick Scott, with Donald Trump, I mean, we've seen this tremendous disruption. Now, I happen to think that, yes, it's going to be very interesting. If DeSantis has no real organization, what kind of a vote count can he get? And then if Corcoran, as everything we see, he is going to enter the race, then that kind of puts another interesting screwball into all of it.
Well, and how do you get to the right of Ron DeSantis? If you're Richard Corcoran, where's your lane in that primary?
Well, we saw a little bit of it with the Sanctuary Cities TV ad that came out a couple months ago from his political committee. That was very controversial. I mean, DeSantis and Corcoran play for the Koch brothers' money. You know, they're kind of working the same fundraising, corner. So it follows that if Corcoran gets in the race, the momentum he takes away is from DeSantis. Mm-hmm. Corcoran, I believe, would help Putnam in the aggregate because, Putnam's running to the right. He's messaged to the right, but Putnam's really out of that more of that Jeb Bush school of Republicanism than the other two are.
And that's a school of Republicanism that's been losing.
It is, but when you're against two candidates who are basically change maker kind of candidates,
and they knock each other out, right. You're saying possibly
right. All the endorsements locally and regionally are going with Putnam. I don't see who gets out there, knocks on doors, and does phone calls for Ron DeSantis. When it gets to be August, and that's really the issue you got to look at here is, when you've got Corcoran in the race, he'll be an X factor. It's going to be hard for him to get to a front runner status, but who does he share votes away from?
Will he be in the race, Gary? I mean, what's your intel tell you?
I continue to have indications that he is serious and he's going to get in the race. And I think, I'm sure AG works for FloridaPolitics.com. I think they've sort of been seeing the same thing. They've been getting the same information. I know it doesn't, for us outside neutral observers, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense because Putnam has been campaigning for so much long and he's got so much money that you're just sitting here, you're sort of saying, can you really jump in a race? I mean, even Rick Scott, who spent $70 million of his own money, he was in the race by now in 2010. Mm-hmm. So, but he enlisted a lot of people, a lot of, important people and well-known people in the political world to help him with his campaign. I don't think they got involved with the thought that they were, he was running for attorney general. So I think that, everything is that it remains a serious endeavor.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Talking about politics this week in the Sunshine State, Tom Hudson along with Melissa Ross. We've also got Gary Fineout with us from the Associated Press and A.G. Gankarski from FloridaPolitics.com. Your phone calls at 305-995-1800 from across the state. Talking about more traditional campaigns versus less disruptive, less traditional, more disruptive campaigns. Other news and notes this week talk about the influence of Facebook, of course. Facebook has been under a lot of scrutiny about the role that it's played in the 2016 campaign. The founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, faced questions from the Tampa Congresswoman Kathy Castor and U.S. Senator Bill Nelson earlier this month on Capitol Hill over the social network's use of private data, yet both Florida Democrats, we come to learn, paid for Facebook ads that target users based on information they collected by the social media outlet. Here's Senator Nelson.
The recent scandal is obviously frustrating, not only because it affected 87 million, but because it seems to be part of a pattern of lax data practices by the company going back years.
Facebook now has evolved to a place where you are tracking everyone. You are collecting data on just about everybody.
Now, the Tampa Bay Times reports that most political campaigns these days pursue voters using personal information collected by Facebook, so that action that lawmakers may take to regulate Facebook could directly impact their own future campaigns. Gary, as the Tampa Bay Times reported this week about the use of Facebook by Congresswoman Caster and Senator Nelson, perhaps no surprise the politicians are using it, but did it fly in contrast to the real line of questioning that they took against the Facebook founder when he appeared before their committees?
Well, I mean, didn't we all kind of ponder what was going on with that hearing and the conversations with the members of Congress and Mr. Zuckerberg and where we were sort of, it was kind of bewildering to have the conversation about the internet and how the internet works and how Facebook works.
Incredible to hear some of the questions from some of these senators. I mean, the absolute lack of any basic knowledge about how the internet works. It was actually quite terrifying.
The fact of the matter is that I think all these campaigns and it's been going on for a while. Yeah, I mean, I can just share my own personal recollection is that in 2012, I had someone show up at my door, knock on the door, and it was somebody I knew who I used to work with, and they were friends with us on Facebook, and they basically, as part of the Obama campaign, were reaching out to people that they knew on Facebook, and they had part of their playbook was go out and make personal contact with your Facebook friends and urge them to vote for President Obama. So I guess I'm just sort of, this side. I mean, I thought that most people kind of knew that social media and Facebook and stuff like that plays a definitive role in how people connect. And I think that the fact that distressing for us in the regular media, when you see this concept that, oh, now most people are getting their news through Facebook, whether you want to get into the whole fake news or not, anything like that, the fact that people are now more apt to read something or look at something because it was shared by a friend on Facebook. So, of course, I mean, I'm not surprised that, all these campaigns want to tap into that power to sort of get their campaigns going.
I'm going to call that the Casablanca moment for you, Gary. You're shocked that social networking data was being mined.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Gary where he's coming from with this. I mean, if you look at targeted advertising, we bought some Florida politics. We have a post we're wanting to promote. We'll target, and you can put in a keyword. So, if it's guns or if it's women's rights or whatever you want it to be, or if it's a consumer item like newspapers, you can target your advertising based on demographics. You can tool your message accordingly. And, when you basically have the biggest repository of advertising information in the world on Facebook, except for Google. And, so obviously it's going to be exploited because people volunteer this information.
That's
people
right.
want to be seen reading and listening and enjoying
And a
things.
Great conversation with UAG of Florida Politics, Gary Fineout of the Associated Press. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. It's our statewide edition this hour. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Well, Florida has more at risk than any other state when it comes to the cost of climate change. That, according to a new study out this week from the magazine Science. Researchers figure climate change will cost this state's economy almost $101 billion, Tom, by the end of this century, because of hurricanes, storm surges, rising sea levels, and other consequences of a warming world.
It's almost an unfathomable number. It's about 10% of the gross domestic product of the state of Florida in the years ahead. This month, meantime, Melissa, the state's Public Services Commission, which is the group that regulates utilities at the state level, it gave the green light to solar company called Sunrun. It allows it to sell its solar lease equipment to homeowners here in Florida. Now, only utilities can legally sell electricity in the state, and the commission said Sunrun does not need its okay now to lease its solar panels. Florida leads the nation this year in the growth of solar panel installations, according to the Solar Energy Industries Association. And in fact, now it's 12th in the nation in rooftop solar installations.
And so two huge energy and climate stories this week for Florida. With her thoughts on both of them, right now we're going to go to Amy Green. She's an environmental reporter with WMFE in Orlando. Now, Amy, in a moment, let's talk solar. But first, your reaction to this study showing Florida, and I think the state right behind it, Texas, stand to lose the most of any states in the union due to the cost associated with climate change. Florida is so vulnerable to this, but as yet we are not seeing an aggressive, you know, policy response to this threat in the state. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of studies showing that the Southeast is, you know, the most vulnerable or one of the most vulnerable regions of the United States to climate change because of the climate here, obviously, and also because of some of the socioeconomic trends here in the region. This decision recently from the Florida Public Service Commission, you know, very interesting development in encouraging solar energy here in the state of Florida, but solar energy remains a small portion of, you know, where the state is getting its electricity. You know, solar energy under the Scott administration has not been something that's really been encouraged. And so a lot of different things at play here.
Then let's talk about if you're a Florida homeowner and you're listening to this, and you hear that Sunrun has gotten this approval to lease solar equipment to homeowners. What's the process then for homeowners to take advantage of this? I know some neighborhoods have put together solar co-ops, you know, to make it a more affordable option if you can't buy the equipment outright. This is a way to lease the equipment, which conceivably would make it available to a lot more people.
Right. It obviously reduces the cost up front for homeowners who are interested in doing solar energy.
But Amy, the decision by the Public Service Commission was a bureaucratic decision. This was not a decision to allow this solar lease group to have its business model in play here in Florida because of climate change, right?
Right. I mean, the important detail here is that the Public Service Commission deemed this request from Sunrun not something where Sunrun is going to be selling electricity to homeowners. And so what the Public Service Commission there is trying to make sure of is that Sunrun is not going to be competing with the major electricity providers like Florida Power and Light and the others.
I guess what's striking is these kind of things happening generally in the same time period. This study, yet another study adding to the canon of scientific studies about how vulnerable Florida is. But this one from Science Magazine looking at the cost to the state economy, and part of that because of the power structure. And then the State Public Service Commission, which regulates electricity, now making it crystal clear that companies that lease solar panels are not in the electricity business. I realize two separate decisions, but when you put them together in the environment here in the state of Florida, both the broad environment, Amy, but also the environment for solar energy, what does that tell you about kind of where we are in the state as state regulators are looking at some of these industries?
You know, look, the trend that we're seeing here in Florida, you know, the state obviously is exceptionally vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise. Under the Chris administration, you know, we were seeing efforts, you know, to engage in solar energy and encourage more, you know, sustainable building, solar energy, those kinds of things. That has changed under the Scott administration. And under the Scott administration, the climate change policy is more focused on disaster mitigation, you know, in response to disasters like Hurricane Irma, you know, things like that.
I don't think the Scott administration would consider that a climate change policy, though, right? We're using that phrase, right?
That's what we're seeing from the, you know, the state departments. You know, there are state departments that are engaging in climate change research and that kind of thing. But I'm speaking generally under the Scott administration. The policy that we're seeing generally is one that's, you know, responding to disasters, disaster mitigation. You know, we're already seeing Florida residents affected by climate change. I'm working on some climate change reporting this week, as a matter of fact. And I talked with a man whose home was very damaged by Hurricane Hermine, which hit the West Coast in 2016. And he is working on rebuilding. He's working on remodeling his house. Unfortunately, the insurance is not paying for a lot of the work that needs to be done. So he's considering moving to another place. You know, this is a man who, well, it's possible he won't be able to afford to have the work done. And, you know, this is a man who already possibly could be displaced by climate change.
And you're listening, and let me just say, you're listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. And Amy Green with WMFE, as you're pointing out, this man you're just describing is one of many thousands of people in Florida already feeling the impacts of climate change, severe weather, eroding sands, rising sea levels, particularly in South Florida. That's already a reality. And you see this striking disconnect whereby local municipalities, particularly in South Florida, are already aggressively figuring out how to deal with rising waters. But we are not seeing, as you pointed out, any kind of aggressive response from Governor Scott's administration. And that shows you how politicized climate is. Republican administrations, at least at the state level, are less likely to respond to this. But, you know, there are Republican mayors and city managers in South Florida responding to this. They've accepted the science behind climate change because the water is coming in and they've got to deal with it. It's a public works and municipal problem. And so how much more evidence do you think we're going to need to see of this impacting Florida for there to be a more robust response to plan for this? Because as Tom pointed out, the economic damages are in the hundreds of billions of dollars potentially.
That's right. You're absolutely right. You know, a lot of the climate change response in the state of Florida is obviously not coming from the state government, but from local governments. And to tell you the truth, if you are going through a hurricane and you're having flooding in your local area, who are you going to call? Are you going to call the state government or are you going to call your local government for help? You know, so a lot of these, a lot of this responsibility, you know, just innately is going to fall on the shoulders of local governments. The question is whether they can handle that responsibility or whether they need more help from state government.
Well, and we've seen, you know, your local government in Orlando make a pretty significant pledge when it comes to its usage of green energy in the years ahead. A major municipality in the state of Florida saying it wants to get all of its electricity from renewable sources, correct?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. There are studies showing that, you know, as people are displaced in the coming years, in the coming decades, as people are displaced from more coastal areas by sea level rise, by climate change, Orlando, Central Florida is going to be one of those places where they end up.
Sure. And North Florida, too, where I sit, climate refugees, people leaving the coast, finding higher ground, finding a drier place to live. You know, Tom, where you are in Miami, you're already seeing a lot of sunny day flooding. That just never used to happen.
Yeah. Elevation zero. No doubt about it. Across in Miami Beach and other neighborhoods. Amy, finally, in regards to this solar lease panel installation decision, how momentous could this decision be for the private solar industry in the state of Florida?
Well, look, you know, there are experts who say that Florida is, you know, an ideal place to develop solar energy. We've got a booming population. We've got obviously sunny weather. But again, solar is a very small portion of where we're getting our electricity from. And so, you know, there would be many who would say that solar is something we need to encourage in our state.
Amy Green covering the environment for our Florida Public Radio partner station, WMFE in Orlando. Amy, always great to have you on the statewide program. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your reporting with us.
Well, finally, this hour, we all know that Florida is hands down the most mocked state in the union. Tom, we get made fun of for just about everything that happens here.
We do. We make it a lot easy, make it very easy for people to do it. But finally, we've gotten something right. We're the state that has created a genius idea, floating tiki bars. This is absolutely great. A tiki on the water. It's the brainchild of a guy from Fort Lauderdale, Greg Darby.
Darby's company, Cruise and Tiki's, has a fleet of 12 floating tiki bars, 7 here in Florida and the rest around the country.
Now, the tiki bars, they've got a built-in wet bar surrounded by stools, a straw roof, and then the distinct possibility, of course, of providing you with some fun times and possibly a hangover.
Hey, you know what? If the water's rising, happy hour is going somewhere, right? On the water,
yep,
it
amen.
Looks like.
There you go.
That's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Mershart are producers.
Jason Zabka, our technical director. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Lebos at AaronLebos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening.